Hey, folks, good afternoon and welcome to this edition of Radio Pride on WCUW 91.3 FM. Every Monday afternoon from 3 to 3:30, we do come your way. Follow us on the World Wide Web at radiopride.net. You can also follow us on the social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Talking Pride. You can reach out to the show off air if you have any ideas or suggestions for show topics or guests at New England Pride Radio at gmail.com. That's neprideradio@gmail.com. And you can call our office off air at 508-556-7367. And the phone line to reach us here in studio during the show, 508-753-2284. That's 508-753-2284. On today's edition, we have a very special guest in studio with us. Laura Matiska joins us. Laurie, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time out and joining us today on Radio Pride.
It's great to be here.
You are a busy lady, and I really do appreciate it. Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year to you and to Teddy.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, yes, he got your birthday wishes. Yesterday was his birthday, and of course, we had a thing to do at the post office pub. We've done it for the last couple of years, so they come out. I mean, they're really good to him there. That's actually part of something we've talked about as far as LGBTQ activities going on in the Central Mass area, and that's the Breakfast Club, and that's something people should check out. It's every 2 weeks. It's usually at the post office pub because when this started years ago, there was four of us, five of us, and we would rotate, you know, go to a different breakfast place, which was great. Then we got to be nine or 10, and it kept growing. And, 20 people could occupy a lot of these breakfast places all at once. So we find they're the only one. We had over 30 people there yesterday. So it's really a great networking opportunity. And I've personally seen a lot of people in the LGBT community, folks, that they look for an outlet. They look for a social platform to go somewhere, and they see this posted. So.
Right. We occasionally have people contact us because of the Safe Homes program and ask what kinds of networking opportunities are available.
Right. Other than the bar. Other than just finding the local bar, the watering hole. Well, we'll talk about some of the activities coming up on the calendar, but let's talk a little bit about the bridge and explain to people what the bridge is. Now, first of all, folks, it's the Bridge of Central Massachusetts. And your position there, Lori?
I'm Vice President of Advancement.
And what would that mean? What is your daily grind? What are you doing?
I do all kinds of fun stuff.
Many hats.
Like this. Yeah. It really is about anything that advances the mission of the organization. So it's about fundraising, marketing, communications, community relations. I have the joy to get involved with a little bit of community health improvement work as well.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about the what and where of the bridge. First of all, let's talk about the history of it, because it's kind of an interesting story, and it's really the merging of two organizations. What's the history there?
The history of the bridge goes back to an era when the movement was to deinstitutionalize folks who were in psychiatric facilities. And that movement led to the formation of a lot of social service or human service agencies. The Bridge is one example. And we started in 1973. You'll see if you look around at a lot of the major human service agencies, they all were forming around that, certainly during that decade. Mm-hmm. The Bridge started as one program. The impetus really came from the closing of the Lyman School for Boys. And they were looking for a residential placement away.
Because all of a sudden you had all these boys who,
right,
who really had nowhere to go or avenues of help.
Right. Yeah. And there was an incredible group at the time. It was a human rights committee in Westboro. And they took this on as a cause. Nice. And some of those folks are still very closely involved in the bridge through a group we have called the Corporators of the Bridge. From that one program, starting in 1973, today the bridge has 50 programs in 17 cities and towns, largely in Central Mass. We do have one Boston program.
That's really incredible. Now, just on the history of it, so the 70s, like you said, there were a lot of these similar organizations. That was the birth decade of that stuff. Now, in the 80s, with the deregulation of a lot of things, and there was a lot of need for mental health facilities and programs, as we know when we look back at the political time. Was there a big growth spurt, or was there anything in the decade of the 80s that was a result of that push?
I think it really comes as a result of that process of deinstitutionalizing large facilities and really helping people integrate into the community, to have meaningful lives as a part of the community. That's really what the Bridge's name means. It's a bridge to the community.
I was going to ask you, because folks, I mean, it's kind of obvious that that's the bridge of the two to bring in together, but see if that's really where it's coming from.
We do have people ask us, though. Yeah. Where's the bridge?
They're looking for the physical bridge, right? I think probably the most famous bridge connected to Worcester would be the Burns Bridge over Lake Quinsigamond.
Yeah. We also sometimes talk about, or we'll have pictures of the Elm Park Bridge, which is a little closer to us.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's tell people actually what we're talking about. Where are you actually located?
So our headquarters are in Worcester, but as I said, we have 17 cities and towns that we serve. We actually serve more cities and towns than that, but we have 17 locations. The folks that we serve have primarily challenges like mental health challenges, developmental disabilities. We have some programs for folks who have brain injury, and these are people who have come out of nursing homes and who, again, want to live independently as they can in the community. We also provide some services for folks with autism. And in the last maybe 10 or 15 years, the Bridge has really built kind of a reputation and programming to help people who are homeless using and a variety of ways, but certainly focusing on folks who have, you know, concurrent mental health challenges, substance use disorders, and who are homeless.
Now, these programs, when you say that you're helping these people, there's two questions I want to get to. One is, of course, it's a very expensive proposition, so where's your funding coming from, and how do you pay for everything? And then the other is, what is it that someone in need of your services are going to expect? Is there counseling? Are there people who know how to fill out all the paperwork? Is there a bridge, if you will, to federal programs that they should, you know about? Is that, in essence, what we're looking at?
Yeah, those are both really good questions. And if we look specifically, for example, at the programs we have for the homeless, they're actually funded through several ways. We received some funding from the Department of Mental Health to run a program called ATARP, and that stands for Aggressive Treatment and Relapse Prevention. And that was a program to provide Housing First, which is an evidence-based model of reaching people who are perhaps living on the streets or in shelters and provide housing for them immediately and then work on other aspects of their lives.
First get them sheltered.
First get them sheltered and don't make a big key of Housing First is that they don't have to necessarily maintain their sobriety or they don't have to achieve certain things in order to stay in the housing. They do have to maintain an adequate relationship with the landlord and, you know, be able to meet the responsibilities. But the kinds of services that we then wrap around them are things like mental health counseling, addiction treatment.
And I would assume that you're making sure that there's either a primary care physician or at least
absolutely.
A mental health doctor involved here, because a lot of people who are homeless or, you know, transient anyway, they don't have normal medical care. They're not seeing a physician
absolutely.
On a normal basis. They don't have a primary care that has their history in front of them. So do you find that a lot of times one of the first things you need to do is get them into a doctor?
Absolutely. connecting them with medical care is often a very early priority. Mm-hmm. Another one you had mentioned is connecting them with benefits that they may have available. Sometimes they haven't necessarily had the ability to apply for things that they're eligible for.
Or just the simple knowledge that they exist.
Right.
I think that there that's a problem I think a lot of people in need have, is they don't understand that there are a lot of programs available, money available, and they really need somebody as a clearinghouse, if you will, that can say, actually, here's your situation, diagnose their situation, and then put the applicable programs, you know, in their path.
Right. So one of the things about the homeless program we have in Worcester is that what we've done is, because the grant that we have from DMH serves 11 people, and we know the need is much greater than that, we've sort of leveraged that support to work with the city through an ESG grant, and we're able to serve another 24 people through that grant at a slightly different level. It's for that program, it's more about giving people help financially with the first, last, and security deposit kind of thing, helping them obtain the housing, and it's still wrapping around as many services as possible. But unlike the ATARP model, we are not actually subsidizing their rent. We're not paying the rent for them.
Okay. So that's one program that is available, the ATARP, but then there's that one that gets, because a lot of times, you know, people can find themselves, okay, they're sustaining a job and they have a budget, and they could make that rent and maybe the cable bill or whatever and feed with maybe assistance. But the point being, it could be $2,400, $3,000 to move into a place between first, last, securities involved. That would be a game changer for a lot of people.
Right.
So to be eligible for that assistance, do they need those things lined up? Do they have to have a job and a minimum? You know, are you going to make sure that they can afford it once you get them set up?
Absolutely. The goal is never to set people up into
failure.
And that's a big part of the service that the Bridge is working with these folks to help them with employment, or in some cases, people want to go back to school. And the Bridge has people who are specially trained to do supported employment and education to help that.
And those funds for that, now when you say, you know, the city program that you're allowed to help 24 more people, is that determined because there's X amount of dollars available and you've calculated that you need X dollars per person, and when you divide that by the money available, you get to 24? Or how do you determine I can help 24 more people?
It's really kind of based on the experience that we've had with the program. We actually apply through the city for these emergency solution grant funds. They actually come from the federal government, but the city administers them. And so we apply for a grant that covers staffing as a primary, as well as some of the financial assistance costs.
And I do want to talk about staffing a little bit, but during the show, Laurie, I'd like to pause for a second. We talk a little bit about the calendar and things that are going on in the LGBTQ community. Of course, we had our second meeting of this year, 2018, last Tuesday night, and a lot of things, of course, are being planned coming up. For instance, we have this Sunday is the Pasta Social. Have you been to that yet?
I have not. I was trying to think if I... We did a
pasta.
We used
to call it spaghetti dinner, but we never served spaghetti yet. So it's a pasta social that we do at the First Unitarian Church on Main Street by the old courthouse. The great setup there. It's a really family-friendly event. It's a really good time. It's, you know, $10 for adults, I think $5 for kids and under a certain age. I don't think it's anything. Pasta, meatball, salad. We call them, of course, the church ladies do a great job baking up a storm. So there's plenty of desserts. We have a kids area, so that you can bring the kids and they have an area to play. And we've done face painting. I don't know if that's there this year, but we've done that in the past. So it's a really good time. And it's the you know, it's just simply Worcester Pride's annual pasta social. So you can check it out, of course, at worcesterpride.org, and there's a Facebook page to go with it as well. And coming up in February, of course, is our farewell to February on the 23rd. You've been to that.
I have not. Okay. I know it's typically at someone's home.
Yes, this is a more... I don't want to use exclusive, but it's not so much opened up, just stride in. It is in a usually held in someone's personal home, which it will be this year. And it kicks off, of course, the fundraising for Worcester Pride, but also we reveal the logo for Worcester Pride that year in the theme. All of that is revealed, so I can't share any of that yet. Being now on the executive board of Worcester Pride, you get privy to a lot of this information. You got to remember what you're not allowed to say, right? it's a great, great time, of course. And so that's farewell to February. And, of course, St. Patrick's Day Parade, Worcester Pride will be in it, which the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Worcester is by invitation. So, of course, Worcester Pride is, I think, our third year, and, you know, we're just very honored and thrilled the fact that we're invited to it, you know, where other cities have so much controversy over LGBTQ into a St. Patrick's Day parade.
One of the things we've certainly noticed through the Safe Homes program is that Worcester Pride is a tremendous partner for our program as well.
Let's talk about Safe Homes for a moment, and we will do another show at some time really about Safe Homes. But Safe Homes is, in fact, under the bridge. So as its supervising agency,
yes.
What is its, what? First of all, what's briefly the history of Safe Homes? How old is Safe Homes and how long has it been around?
Sure. Going back to the mid-90s, Judy Kirk and a couple of other folks in the community really felt the need for a program to provide supports and for youth who are LGBTQ. And at that time, they started out, I think, somewhat independently. For a short time, they were part of another agency, and then they approached the bridge. And I want to say it's somewhere around 1996, 97, that the bridge said, yeah, we would be happy to have them become a part of the bridge. Mm-hmm. Barry Walsh, who was the executive director at the time, believed very passionately that the mission of Safe Homes was a very good fit for the mission of the bridge. And certainly...
Sure, certainly a lot of overlapping as far as right. tasks at hand.
Right. Right.
Now, and Judy Kirk is chair of the bridge.
That's correct.
Now,
Judy
yeah.
is currently chair of the board of for the
board.
Bridge.
Yeah, the bridge, okay.
Right. And Peter Bakiaki yep. is a member of our board yep. as well.
Yep.
As well as obviously president of Worcester Pride.
Yes, he's still there. We're not letting him go from that. we had that discussion in the first meeting, and we did do some. I've been elected as vice president, and
yes.
The member at large has been filled by Julie Kattar. So we have our 5-member executive board in place. So
that's
everything's
great.
Good there. But we're going to make Peter hold on for a little while longer.
Peter's terrific.
Peter has all of that experience and connections and knowledge that he just gets things done, and we're all trying to learn from him right now.
Yeah.
It's just
including
what has
me.
To be done. Yeah. So that's great. So the board. So let's talk a little bit about staffing the board. So on the board, Judy Kirk is the chair. Of course, Peter Bakiaki's there. And Paulette is currently on the board, too.
Paulette Gayden.
Yeah. And who else do we have on the board? Donna Conley,
right.
Charles Wood. These are all board members.
Don Doyle.
Yeah, there's a lot. I have all this information on radiopride.net. So you can check the post that Lori's coming on, and you'll see information about the bridge, its board members, its mission. In its mission statement. So back to a little bit about the staffing. How big is the staff to handle all of these programs?
So that's a really good question, because if you looked at the total number of people we serve and you looked at the fact that we have 600 staff, it would seem like we have a lot of staff.
Right.
And the reality is we provide services that are... this sort of a variety of levels of intensity of the service. So we operate a number of what used to be called group homes. And in those programs, people, it's where people are living. It is their home. There might be 5 or 6 or 8 people living together in what we refer to as a GLE, or group living environment.
You have to have at least 24 hours a day somebody available, if not physically there.
That's exactly right.
So, this is not a small undertaking.
So that's one level of intensity and of staffing. And then what you hope will happen is for people who come into that setting, maybe they came out of Worcester Recovery Center, and now they're going to integrate into the community, and so they start in a residential treatment program or a GLE. And then you, in some cases, people are able to progress to a more independent level of living. So they might move into a supported housing program, and there's different levels of intensity of those programs based on how frequently
staff need to go. So as these people progress in their journey, the need for the intense and more staff kind of lightens up. I mean, the whole idea is for them to become more and more independent.
That's right. Okay. And again, integrate successfully in the community.
Okay. Can we go back to safe homes as we're headed to wrap up? Because I'm fortunate enough to be involved with some of the safe homes gala, and that's an annual event, and that's coming up, and we can talk about that because we've said everything, the information.
Sure.
And what is it, and what does it fund, and why does it exist?
The Safe Homes Gala is one of the most important ways that we generate funding for the Safe Homes program, which is a drop-in center and a variety of other supports for LGBT youth who are 14 to 23. The program is really what I would consider a youth development model. A lot of the young folks who come through the program gain confidence. They end up becoming leaders, whether it's at the center, at the Safe Homes program itself, or for other clubs and organizations, which is awesome.
It gives them confidence in some of the tools for them to take out into the world. Yeah.
Exactly. So the Safe Homes Gala is going to be coming up May 4th. It's going to be this year. We're very excited about the fact that it is going to be at a brand new location at the AC Marriott Hotel.
I believe we're going to be the first major function there, right?
I think we're one of, if not the first. Yeah,
it'll still have that new fresh smell, though.
Yes,
right?
It will. It'll still have that new car smell.
Yeah, going on. That's good.
Yeah, no, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
The Safe Homes Gala is more than just a fundraising event. It's also a chance for us to recognize people in the community who have either shown great courage in supporting youth, LGBTQ youth, or also we have an award that's a social justice advocacy and action award. So there's a series of awards. In fact, nominations close this week.
Yes.
So we need, if people have...
Where can we go for nominations?
You can go to the Safe Homes website, which is www.safehomesma.org.
Make sure you put that MA.
Yeah, if you don't put the MA, it's not going to get
you
there.
And it is a .org.
Correct.
So safehomesma.org, and that will bring you to the Worcester Bay Safe Homes.
Right.
And there is a tab or box or something that will bring you to the nomination area. So you can nominate, and that's how you get these recipients, is through public nomination.
Correct.
And then the committee determines, or is it all in the votes?
The committee will actually vote coming up on January 30th.
Okay. And once this is set and the recipients are set, are they notified and, of course, asked that they're going to receive it? And is that information released prior to that night, or is that a reveal?
No, it's actually released in advance so that we have the opportunity for people to, as we're sending out invitations, we include the recipients on the invitation.
Sure, because, of course, that might cause some people to want to come that night. Now, the last few years I've been involved, it's been a sellout activity.
Because
the activity itself is a great time.
Yep. The event has sold out the last 2 years. And in fact, last year's event was, we were a bit packed in the space.
Yeah.
So that kind of prompted the the need to look for a new space. We're going to have a lot of flexibility this year with the size of the space that's available.
Okay.
So we're hoping to attract more people.
And the money that is raised from this gala, some of it is earmarked, right? Because some of the fundraising is people can fund a certain need.
Yes.
Which is really cool.
Right. We typically do a fund a need that will identify specific project or specific need at the Safe Homes drop-in. Yeah. But all of the funds raised do benefit the Safe Homes program.
And that's fantastic because that in itself, I mean, it does such great work. The center that you talk about, I think it's Thursday night, is kind of an open night for them to come in.
It's a drop-in.
A drop-in and a specific food bank for LGBTQ youth or in danger, which is, you know, there. And they've recently kind of expanded that with the closet.
Right.
So this
there's a closet of transgender supplies. There are also a couple of newer things at the drop-in. One is the availability of some housing resources. We were talking about homelessness before. And also a supported employment person is now attending the drop-in to help the youth find jobs.
And that's a huge thing. Yes, because a lot of these kids, if you will, they don't know how to go about getting this stuff, whether it's getting a place to live, and they have, you know, we can get into a whole nother show about the home life and the issues that they have, but learning how to find a job, write a resume, fill out an application, and go on an interview.
Right.
So that was great. We're running out of time, but I want to, again, thank you so much for taking time out and joining us here on Radio
Pride.
My
pleasure.
Tell everybody where to find your on the web again for The Bridge.
For The Bridge, it's www.thebridgecm.org.
All right. Fantastic. All right, folks, check us out on radiopride.net. Follow us on social media platforms at Talking Pride. I'm Joe Mangiacotti, and we're here Mondays at 3 o'clock on WCUW 91.3 FM.
Stronger together, ooh, joyful smiles with Talking Pride.